This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. When it comes to money and personal finance, what are your resolutions for the new year? Saving for retirement, college tuition? It's tough to do without goals and a plan. This afternoon, investing right for 2014. But first, international investing might be on your to-do list in the new year. Financial advisor Chris DeSimio joins me along with Aaron Katzman, founder and president of Lighthouse Capital. And good to see you, Chris. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Mark. It's good to be here. And, you know, on the way down, I noticed the temperature soaring into the 30s. I think I saw some swimming pools open and people harvesting tomatoes down there.
Feels like a virtual heat wave, doesn't it?
It does. It does. We're joined, actually. We've never done this before. All the way from Jerusalem in Israel is Aaron Katzman, who has been in the financial services industry for many years and has been on CNBC. He manages money for people all around the globe. Aaron had been with Citigroup for a number of years in the private banking side and started his own firm, Lighthouse Capital. And Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. What's the weather like there in Jerusalem where you are now?
The swimming pools have been open here for a long time. It's 60s today.
Wow. Nice. Speaking of 60s, the Dow Jones Industrial Average at this very minute, 107 Eastern Time, is down about 69 points. We had some news today. The ADP figures were a little stronger than expected, the employment-wise. But, you know, it's funny, Aaron, you develop portfolios for people all around the world. And here in the United States, we are a nation of news hounds, it seems. There's a 24-hour news cycle, and people watch TV or they listen here to public radio. They listen to the BBC World News overnight. And, you know, that accounts for the big bags under our eyes. Is it like that in Israel? Do people get distracted by the news of the day? And does it take people away from their goals as much in Israel as it does here in the United States?
Yeah, for sure. You know, here at the top of every hour, you know, whether you're on a bus or you're in an office or wherever you are, everybody listens to the news at the top of the hour. It's really, you know, it's a fascinating phenomenon because things here change so fast. And unfortunately, we've been the recipients of, you know, over the years of tragic news or what have you. So people always want to be tuned in. On the business side, you know, in many ways, the Israel startup nation sort of powering the world technologically means that people in Israel have to be, you know, on a 24-hour news cycle as well. And they have to really know what's going on in Europe to a lesser extent and very much so in the United States and especially sort of in the Western time zones, what's going on out in Silicon Valley. So we're tied to the news every bit as much as you guys are.
Of course, in Silicon Valley, it's 10 o'clock Eastern. The Consumer Electronics Show is going on out there, and Samsung is unveiling a wraparound TV. What time is it there in Jerusalem right now?
Right now, it's about 10 after 8 p.m.
Wow. So you're skipping your dinner or after dinner to be with us.
My wife's got it warming up for me in the oven.
Great. Your book, Global Retirement GPS, has a global bent to it. To what extent have you felt that people around the world tend to kind of localize their investing experience?
It's very much similar to the United States. Now, there was some research done years ago out of Atlanta, and they looked at people's stock holdings in Atlanta and Georgia, you know, in general, and they found, without question, the most popular holding was Coca-Cola stock. And, you know, that sort of spurred what was known as the home bias. And the home bias really holds true everywhere. Whether, you know, when I was with Citibank, we did a lot of work through Europe, and European financial models call for investing in Europe, and U.S. models call for investing, you know, in the United States. The point of my book, The Retirement GPS, is to sort of break down that barrier and for people to sort of open their eyes and look for opportunity. The world's a really, really big place. And there's a lot of exciting things going on, and for people to sort of be, you know, stuck on, you know, buying companies that are down the block from them as opposed to opening their eyes and looking for opportunities is a real shame.
I haven't gotten all my fourth quarter material in yet. It's just starting to roll in. I guess it would have been here if the weather hadn't been so crummy, but we didn't get mail yesterday until very late. And the post office generally does a really, really great job. But one of the things that I noticed last quarter, Aaron, was that as great a quarter in the third quarter as we had when the domestic market was up about 5.5% U.S., that many European markets actually did quite well. The U.K. was up over 12% in the third quarter, Germany up nearly 13%, Spain was up about 25%, and Greece, of all things, was up 33%. And so far this year, some of those smaller European countries are getting off to a better start. Is that a place that a typical investor, whether they're in Jerusalem or in Cincinnati, might want to look for some income from some of the bigger European companies?
Yeah, I think so. I think that in terms of Europe, it's more about valuation, that Europe over the previous 5 or 6 years, while the U.S. was going through a subprime crisis, not only did that impact European markets, but European markets had a whole currency crisis and the almost bankruptcy of a good chunk of the continent. You mentioned Greece and Spain and Portugal. The reason they've been up so strongly is that the economic data coming out of those countries is a little bit better than expected, and it looks like they're out of the woods. And those countries really, really took it on the chin. So it's only natural, for what falls hard can rise fast. So that makes it interesting on a valuation level. I think that the real place that investors want to look, according to all economic data, is really Asia, and maybe even some of the frontier markets. But Asia, whether it's Hong Kong and Singapore, South Korea, not including Japan, and we can leave China out of the mix for a second, but all data shows there is going to be a huge, huge amount of wealth creation in that part of the world over the next 20 years, which means that there's going to be a huge new consumer base that has a lot of money to burn. And I think investors would be wise, to target some money in those areas.
Aaron Katzman with Lighthouse Capital, a couple other questions. Israel, of course, is home to Teva Pharmaceuticals, among other, and we try to stay away from naming individual companies. But just out of curiosity, in which continent is – I always think of Israel as having more of a European bent since you're right there on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean. But are you included in the European indices or in Asian indices?
We used to be included in emerging market indices.
Okay.
And then recently, about 2 years ago, the OECD upgraded us to developed nation status.
Okay.
So we're sort of more less on the regional indices. I mean, you'll never find us really on an Asian index. You might find us a little bit on a European index, but usually it's more of on international, sort of broader-based indices is where Israel usually falls.
And what are some of the publicly traded sectors that are big regionally there in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean? Is it, you mentioned technology. Are there any other sectors
as far as Israel is concerned, technology is huge. One thing that people don't really realize is that they're more, outside of China, they're more Israeli companies that trade actually in the United States on U.S. markets than any other country in the world, which is fascinating, and more than the U.K., more than Canada, second just to China. And most of what's going on, from Israel is technology. When you go to other countries, it's more sort of bread and butter. You'll find, the telecommunications company that trades, the banks that trade. That's usually maybe an electric company. That's usually the recipe in emerging markets. The companies that are listed on the U.S. exchanges are going to be those types of companies, again, outside of Israel, where it's almost, it's 85% technology.
Well, Aaron Katzman, I want to thank you so much for taking time away from your dinner to be with us, and we'll get you back and we'll go in more detail into your book, The Retirement GPS. And thank you so much for being with us in this first segment of the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
We'll continue our conversation about investing resolutions for 2014 after the break, and you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Financial advisor Chris DeSimeo joins me along with John Schmitz, Vice President and Principal at Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel. And Jason Jackman, President and Chief Investment Officer for Johnson Investment Counsel. And as we talk about investing resolutions for the new year, you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jason, personally, I'd like to make some good decisions about saving and investing this year. So what's the starting point for most people? What's the basic building block that we should be considering as we enter the new year?
Well, certainly you want a broadly diversified portfolio for a start. Last year was certainly a very positive surprise, with the S&P 500 exceeding 32%. And it was a year where we had very modest economic growth, but a much better than expected stock market. This year could be the reverse, where we have better economy, but maybe a more modest stock market, given the fact that we're starting at higher valuations.
I'd also add, this is John Schmitz, that you really just need to start with a plan. Have a plan and be disciplined about following it. There are so many individuals out there who have a plan for retirement that are now seeing 5-0, 6-0, and even 7-0, around the corner, and they haven't done much planning in terms of retirement. And the statistics I've been reading is that more and more people over the last 5 years are unprepared for retirement.
Boy, isn't that the truth? What kinds of elements, what kinds of things should be in that plan? What should they be considering?
Yeah, I would say fundamentally you have to look at your lifestyle and say, what will my needs be? What are my needs now? And do I have an asset basis to sustain that lifestyle, down the road when I do retire? Or if I don't, how do I get there?
It's amazing how frequently people wrestle with that idea as they approach retirement. And we seem, as this baby boom generation, all 75 million of us, start rounding third, as Joe Nuxall would say, and start heading for home and the dugout and the locker room of life. Mm-hmm. Oh, what an analogy. Yeah. Anyway, as we start rounding that corner, you start looking at that and saying, am I ready? What kind of income do I really need? And it seems really difficult for some people to get their arms around that. At what point do people need to start making that decision, that lifestyle decision? Is it 2 years out, 3 years out, 10 years out? Where do you start thinking, okay, the kids are going to be gone. I'm not going to be supporting them as much. I don't need this. I don't need that. I really don't need a new car every other year. At what point do people start kind of hunkering down and saying, okay, this is what the rest of my life is going to look like?
Mm-hmm. Generally not soon enough, because the sooner the better is the way
point.
To go.
Mm-hmm.
You have to save much less incrementally the younger you start in your life. And the key, as John mentioned, was creating a plan to save and build that nest egg and then have a spending plan that aligns with that nest egg that you've saved.
The studies that show people saving early, starting earlier, and letting the miracle of compound growth work for them instead of against them. It truly is remarkable.
It is. And what I think is pretty interesting is that there were a lot of discouraged investors 5 years ago. The market was down, 35% or so 5 years ago. And that really discouraged a lot of people from investing in stocks. And what we've seen subsequent to that is 5 straight years of positive returns for the S&P. 1 year was single digits, 4 out of 5 were double digits. Last year was over 30%. And that's where you can't control the value of the market, but if you stay in the market long term, you should be good.
And there seems to be this question of behavioral finance, this recency issue, where 42 years ago when our family moved from Burbank, California, where you went to the snow, it didn't come to you. When we moved to southwestern Ohio, that first winter in early 1972, it was brutally cold. But it was the first and only one I'd ever been through. Mm-hmm. So I just assumed that, they must all be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're here, as our niece is now from Burbank, California, this is her first winter here, her assumption is, of course they're all like this. And so for people just getting started in the market, last year, as you said, the Standard & Poor's 500 was up 32%. Do you think there's a risk that people just entering the market might start to set their sights a little too high and start thinking this is normal the way they did 15 years ago at the height of the internet bubble?
Yeah, I think there is a real risk. And you've seen, some damaged investors out there who maybe get too conservative. And one of the offsets of the Fed policy that we've seen is very low interest rates on savings and very safe investments. So there are ways to provide a diversified portfolio that mitigates some of that volatility in the stock market, but it's important to have broad-based allocation to these growth areas of the market because the opportunity cost of being invested too safely, too much in risk-free assets is you're just not going to get there, especially adjusting for inflation.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And John, I guess as you start into this planning process, wise thing to do is take a personal inventory. Where do I stand now? What do I have already in terms of pension, retirement plan, any savings, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think if you approach an advisor like Chris or you can access, I think, some basic questions just on the internet to help you guide you through your inventory, because you do have to account for, you know, perhaps there, I do have a pension plan coming. I do have life insurance. I do have a 401k. I do have assets that I've inherited, those kinds of situations. But yes, you've got to inventory it, compare that against what you expect your lifestyle to be, and then move forward from there.
And I guess you also should look at your budget and what your debt load is also.
Absolutely. Always better to have less.
Absolutely. Speaking of debts, a lot of people find this personal experience. I put two kids through college and wasn't prepared for it, so we went the route of student loans. Mm-hmm. We always talk about planning for retirement. I think a lot of times planning for college education for our kids falls by the wayside.
I agree. I have two in college, one a year away from college, and another one 5 years away from college. And I can tell you that we depleted the assets for, you know, my college savings just by the first two. So I can appreciate that. You've got to really plan, and it continues to get more expensive.
What are some steps you should take as far as, is it a balancing act? I can plan for both college retirement or for college and for retirement at the same time, or do you have to, how do you do that?
Yeah, your horizon for college is going to be shorter, mm-hmm. obviously, but you have to allow for the assets to grow to help you afford the college tuition. But your horizon for college, I remember back in my 30s thinking, I'm going to need this when I'm in my 50s. But retirement really wasn't on the forefront. It was further down. And now retirement is slowly working its way into my picture, but college tuition is still banging on the door.
Well, yeah, some parents
like an Arctic vortex.
Like an Arctic vortex. You would come up with that, wouldn't you, Chris? You know, some parents might take from their retirement plan to pay for college. Is that a smart thing to do?
Well, there's opportunity cost with that. You know, anytime you take from one pocket and put it in another pocket, then you miss out on the opportunity in the pocket you took from. So you've got to balance that against each other, and you've got to weigh the cost of borrowing for college as well, and what rates and how you have to pay that back over time.
You know, it's interesting too. You have to, as you start to figure out how to, you know, that you have to save, that you have to deny yourself the current gratification of spending on whatever it is you want to spend on and divert some of your check, some of your paycheck into savings. You have to have some kind of sense of where the economy is going to go. Both of your firms, Ball & Gaynor and Johnson Investment Counsel, come out with, you know, market forecasts, and you have to start with an assessment of where you feel the economy is going to go. We'll start with you, John. Mm-hmm. How is your firm's outlook? What is your firm's outlook for 2014, and how does it differ from what you thought was going to happen last year?
You know, we thought the economy would be slower in 2013. It wasn't robust, but it wasn't as slow as we thought. We thought that the headwinds of higher taxes earlier in the year would weigh. We thought earnings would be slower. And we had absolutely a decent economy. It's not still not great. It's sort of muddling along. But looking forward, I still think that we have good earnings potential. What we still need, though, is some good revenue growth, some demand-based growth, just not in our own country, but from around the world. And if we get that, we're going to have even more robust economy and even more robust corporate earnings, which have actually been pretty good over the last few years, but more of a fact that they have been assisted by lower debt costs because interest rates have been so low. And more operating efficiencies, not driven so much by the sales line.
So generally, you're not looking for the bottom to fall out then?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think that valuations of any of the markets are outrageous either. They look pretty much close to historical norms, but what has been driving this market has been a recovery of the valuation, but earnings growth as well.
Not the historical norm from Cheers, but the other kind of norm. Jason Jackman, what's the outlook there at Johnson Investment Counsel? Is it pretty much shared with what John is saying?
Yeah, we also expect a marginally better economy. When you add up all the things the economy faced last year, we entered the year facing the fiscal cliff, the payroll tax hike,
The sequester,
mm-hmm. Debt ceiling debates, government shutdown, and it weathered that extremely well, posting a yearly economy south of 2%, which isn't great. But when you think about entering next year, we'll have less fiscal drag, less government in the way. We have a manufacturing sector that has a fair amount of momentum entering the year, and really a tailwind of low commodity prices assisting the consumer. When we put all that together and a Fed that is, while tapering, is not yet tightening, we think growth can be better next year.
What are your resolutions for saving and investing in the new year? Give us a call and join our discussion, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
I like that, tapering, not tightening. That's been the big discussion. There were so many pieces that fell into place last year that people were concerned about. January, where the tax cuts expire, then March, the dreaded sequester, as you mentioned, Jason, that the fear of a government shutdown, which came to pass, and yet the market seemed to kind of shrug these off. What is 2014? Then, are there some sectors of the market that you think might do better than others? That if the economy is in fact going to grow, would be well served to invest in more industrial and basic materials kinds of sectors as opposed to the tried and true consumer staples? What are your thoughts sector wise?
When we look at some of the sectors, we are seeing some areas that are getting somewhat expensive, and some of those are in the areas you mentioned. The tried and true consumer staples, the steady eddies, have gotten somewhat expensive as people have been attracted to that safety and potentially that dividend yield. Where we see relative value most right now tends to be in industrial companies, particularly those that have exposure to the domestic economy, U.S. economy in this market, and also technology companies that have traded very reasonable valuations, have a lot of cash on the balance sheet, are now beginning to pay a dividend, look relatively attractive to us. So those are two sectors that we find particularly attractive right now.
Yeah, John's shaking his head, yeah, because 20 years ago at your firm, dividend growth, you either couldn't or wouldn't own technology, and now that's changed a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, oddly enough, the biggest dividend-paying sector now is technology.
Yeah.
Wasn't that way 14, 15 years ago. I would also add to Jason's comments that perhaps some of the banks look pretty attractive. Some have recovered and are setting new highs. However,
unimaginable 5 years ago.
Yeah. But banks, given a shift in the yield curve, which when I say that, I mean intermediate to longer term rates are rising. Short-term rates, which is what the Fed controls, are still very low, in which savings rates are based on. So the banks are borrowing from their consumers at very low rates in their deposit rates, but they're also investing at higher rates now than they had been over the past 12 to 18 months.
So in this circumstance, rising rates actually might be good for banks.
Rising long-term rates, not rising short-term rates. And we're not probably going to see rising short-term rates for some time, according to the Fed.
So this reduction of the QE3, which is now down from $85 billion to $75 billion, do you think it, either of you think it will get to zero by the end of the year, or will the Fed still be in there kind of propping it up a little bit?
I think it'll probably be a very slow, very methodical approach. What they're doing now is a drop in the bucket compared to the total effort. They're reducing their buys by $10 billion. That's almost nothing. But they're letting the market know to adjust to this process. And it'll eventually happen, but they're nowhere near tightening yet.
Nowhere close.
Yes, they've accompanied the taper talk with the idea that they're going to keep short-term rates lower for longer as a way to talk the market expectations into expecting this.
John, I always hear the expression, invest in what you know, invest in what's close to home. So is it a good idea to look into something like Kroger, look into Procter & Gamble, or does it bear more investigation than just saying that's the hometown company, I should put my money in it?
Well, I think you really have to investigate every company you want to invest in. But we have some good home-based companies here. But it is interesting, what Aaron was saying is that they're so local-centric about the approach they take to investing all around the world.
I thought we had a monopoly on hometown bias here.
If you lived in Indianapolis, you're going to be lot of Lilly stock.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of P&G holders. We have a lot of Kroger holders in town. They happen to be two very good, well-run companies. And Kroger's done a good job with the Dunnhumby development, which is now building the new structure over on Ray Street. Great market research, great way that when you go to Kroger now, you do get coupons that you find quite valuable, and which is a way to create your repetitive shopping at Kroger. And I think that's a very good approach. And Kroger's done very well.
Well, how do you know when you're doing research? How do you find good, reliable information versus just hype on companies?
Yeah, I think what you have to appreciate is if you're a consumer, which we all are, and you like a product, and you look at a company that you think is doing well, you just experience it yourself. If it's a good experience, chances are it's probably a pretty good company too. So if you look at it from that, and then you just look at some of the basic fundamentals of the history of the company, have they been growing? Do they reward shareholders? What is their approach to operating their company? That kind of thing. Very basic approach to that way you can at least appreciate what a good company would be for you and what a good company won't be for you.
You know, it's an amazing thing too, as you talk about people getting started investing and wondering what to invest in. It's hard now when you go online to avoid the ads that talk about so-and-so's latest pick. This is the next stock that could go up by 1,500%. Just in time for that movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, The Wolf of Wall Street, believe it or not, there are still people out there doing that with the so-called pump and dump scheme or scam, where you have a company that's a shell company that's never made a profit, never made a product, and yet somehow people start promoting it. The stock goes up. It like moths to the porch light. People start gathering around it. The prophecy fulfills itself just in time for the people promoting it to vamoose, to exit, leaving investors holding the bag.
Right. You just don't make a lot of money over a short period of time. The wealth I see created, I'm sure Jason's same situation, is made when we look at portfolios of elderly people who've owned certain companies for a long time.
Shall remain nameless.
Yes.
I'm sure a lot of planning and thought went into the whole strategy, too, to generate that wealth.
You think about it. Sometimes it can be very complicated. Sometimes it can be very simple. But if there is a company that you like, you like their business, you like their product, take a stab at it and put a few $100 and buy some stock.
Yeah, a lot of people work for publicly traded companies, mm-hmm. and they get it offered in their retirement plans. Mm-hmm. Is it a good idea to take your company stock inside your retirement plan?
It depends on your own diversified situation. And if you don't have any other company stock, perhaps. But if you own a lot of company stock outside your retirement plan and you're not diversified, you've got to keep that in mind as well.
And certainly take advantage of any company matches that exist, because that's the best return you can get, is maximizing that match.
So for somebody who's just starting out, who hasn't started investing on their own yet, I guess your retirement plan is a good way to get rolling, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, especially if the company's matching.
Yeah.
It's free money for you.
Yeah. To not at least contribute the fullest amount to get the company match is essentially saying, I don't want the free money, keep it.
Mm-hmm. But do your homework in a 401k plan. These are your decisions about your money and how you're going to invest it, and make sure that you're well educated from your provider, typically your company, on what your options are and that you understand them.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email us at talk@wvxu.org. And, you know, say a stock costs $10 a share, and I really can't afford to buy 100 shares. Is there a way that people can start small? I mean, I know you can start small with your retirement plan, but are there other ways people can invest where they don't have to lay out huge amounts of money right off the bat?
Certainly mutual funds are a way to do that, as well as ETFs, as a way to get a low nominal investment started in a diversified manner, which oftentimes can be your best bet, so you don't have all your eggs in one basket.
What's a good first investment for the total novice? Would it be stocks? Would it be bonds? Would it be the mutual fund? Would it be an ETF?
Well, you first have to ascertain your goal and your horizon. What am I saving for? Am I saving for my car, my next car? Or am I saving for education? Or am I saving for retirement? Or am I saving for a house? But if your horizon is shorter, then you're typically going to be less risky because you don't want to have any of that money lost. So if you have a horizon of about a year, if you're saving for your next car and you need a $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 down payment, you probably don't want to put that in stocks. You probably want to keep that more safe so that you don't lose any of that principal when you know you need it. But longer-term horizons would have more of an allocation to more aggressive assets that can go up in value but also can go down, but you hope they go up over long periods.
Well, what are your financial resolutions for 2014? We'll keep that discussion going after the break, and you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. In about 10 minutes, Ann Thompson reports on how to protect your online reputation. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. My guests are financial advisor Chris DeSimeo, John Schmitz, vice president and principal at Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel, and Jason Jackman, president and chief investment officer for Johnson Investment Counsel. Also, Chris?
You know, people are still looking for income. There are about 10,000 baby boomers a day now calling it quits, hanging it up. And they need income. And it used to be that, you know, you could count on a certain stream of income. But now dividend yields 3, 3.5, maybe 2, 2.5, depending. They can grow for sure. But if you'd rather have higher income and don't want to tie up money in a 10-year bond, the Treasury just announced today they auctioned off more than $20 billion of 10-year notes that went off at just a shade over 3%, okay, which is high compared to where it was. But still, that doesn't get the job done for a lot of people. And so there's been a lot of talk about these energy income ideas where you just own the toll road over which oil and natural gas flows, these so-called pipelines. Mm-hmm. What are the opportunities and some of the risks that investors face who might want to derive income from that area? Well, I mean, there are so many different structures, so many formats. Jason and John, what do you generally prefer?
There is a structure that has become and continues to become more popular called the Master Limited Partnership. And there are dozens of Master Limited Partnerships that perform various functions within the energy process. But the most popular ones are the midstream energy pipelines, which are the ones who actually, once it gets out of the ground, they process it, they move it, they clean it, they ship it, distribute it. And those have become very popular. The MLP structure is a little unique because the distribution you receive is a return of your capital in some cases and some income. So it's a different tax treatment. It's a very attractive yield. Many of them are yielding 6 or 7% today. But you just have to be mindful that the whole tax treatment of an MLP is quite different than the standard dividend.
And it may complicate your return a little bit if you own a structure that generates a K-1 instead of a 1099.
That's correct.
That's sure, for sure, but you do get some deferred income benefit on that. It's really a unique, unique category in that it has very attractive yield, as you mentioned. It has the growth capabilities to it with the build-out of the whole infrastructure in the U.S. for the transmission of energy throughout the country. And it also has some inflation hedging properties. A lot of these contracts are written in a long-term manner in which the increases in the contracts relate to the producer price index, which allows for some inflation hedging as well.
Right.
With the price of natural gas now going up a little bit, but it's still low compared to where it was a few years ago.
Right.
Has that at all discouraged people from looking for new gas formations, or which might diminish the demand to move this stuff around? Or is there just industrial base here in the United States getting so robust, or at least less anemic, that the demand for natural gas is going to be high enough that these will be profitable enterprises going forward?
Oddly enough, the natural gas rig count is declining.
The rig count, the number of rigs out there, guys drilling for people drilling for
natural gas.
Okay.
The number of oil rigs is increasing. The reason we're still producing more natural gas is some of the offshoot of an oil rig is natural gas. So there's so much natural gas right now that we know we can get to when we need to get to it. But the biggest and most prolific one is the Marcellus, which is in some of Ohio, but mostly West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York. And I think the evolution here is that there was so much discovery of oil and natural gas as a result of technology development over the last 5 years that the supply has actually surpassed the demand in the short term. What we have now is to find demand for using of the natural gas. It's a lot cheaper now because we haven't have enough demand. We need cars to be developed to use natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
We need to develop an infrastructure of natural gas filling stations around the country. And we need to be able to ship natural gas in a liquid form around the world. And as these things develop, the demand for natural gas will pick up.
We got a question from Richard. He's 62, no mortgage, just inherited $300,000. He says he has no idea what to do with it. So he's looking for suggestions. He also says he's single and owns his home, and he is collecting Social Security. So he's wondering what the heck to do with all that money.
Last week we would have said take the Bengals and the points, but
not this week.
I think given his situation, I don't know how many children he has. I don't know about his lifestyle, but I would first take a step back and look at himself and say, is my lifestyle being supported by my other income, and will it always be supported by my other income? Or do I need this $300,000 to help supplement that when the time comes for me to ultimately let go and retire in full?
The longer the time horizon, the more you can dedicate to variable assets. And so if he doesn't need it within the next, say, 5 to 10 years, he can devote more and more of that $300,000 towards variable indices like stocks.
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot of talk about what kind of distribution level is an appropriate number for someone to take who's in their early 60s. Used to be that people would look at the chart and say, oh, well, stocks have averaged 10%. I just inherited $300,000. I'll take $30,000 a year from that for the rest of my life. But that ignores the sequence of returns. What are you using in your practices at Ball & Gaynor and Dick Johnson Investment Counsel for someone such as Richard who is saying, okay, what can I expect in distribution-wise from a pool of money?
We use some fairly sophisticated scenario analysis to run future paths of volatility of various asset class mixes. And what traditionally that has shown is about a 5% withdrawal rate has been very comfortable, so that you're worried about not running out of money by your lifetime. And someone who's healthy at age 62 should really plan on living to 95 or longer to make sure you don't run out of assets in that time period. But given the slower rate of growth we've had domestically, given the tempered rate of returns, that traditional 5% number is more like 4% today to feel really confident.
And I'd also just interject that you've got to keep looking at this over and over. You know, every 2 or 3 years, revisit it, because the 5% might be good. 3%, you know, might be appropriate given the situation and the times, and maybe you can adjust up again to 5%. So really, you've got to adjust, reevaluate your situation regularly.
And we got about a minute left in the conversation here. So what's your top piece of advice? Start with you, John.
Just be disciplined and take the new year opportunity to make sure you've got a plan and got your estate situation set and put together a plan for yourself for, you know, your financial short term, your financial long term.
A written plan, I take it, would be the best option to go with?
Sure. That way you have something to refer to.
don't just trust it to memory, right? If you're Chris DeSimio, you forget 5 minutes later, right, Chris?
Oh, ouch. Yeah. At least save it as a PDF. If you don't pray, you don't have to it doesn't have to be written, but at least it's writable.
Jason, your top piece of advice.
Yeah, certainly writing it down definitely increases the odds of sticking to that plan. Certainly commit to save in the new year. It has been a more challenging environment for investing over the past, say, 10 years. But the environment for the U.S. economy is improving. The outlook for U.S. investments is improving. So stick to a plan of disciplined investing with diversification.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Financial advisor Chris DeSimio, John Schmitz, Vice President and Principal at Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel, and also Jason Jackman, President and Chief Investment Officer for Johnson Investment Counsel.